Good afternoon. This is Kara James. I'm the director of the CMS Office of Minority Health, and I would like to welcome you all to our webinar that we're having on Reducing Disparities in Healthcare Quality, Partnership for Patients. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by several of my colleagues, Dennis Wagner, Paul McGann, and Xanthia James from our Center for Clinical Standards and Quality, and by Dr. Bruce Siegel to talk to you today about this very important issue and what we're doing with Partnership for Patients. As you know, April is National Minority Health Month, and our theme this year is Prevention is Power, Taking Action for Health Equity. And as Secretary Sebelius stated, it's a time to raise awareness about health disparities that persist among racial and ethnic minorities, and it's also a time for us to spotlight the work that we're doing to help eliminate the disparities that we see, and to focus on the work particularly of the HHS Action Plan to reduce racial and ethnic health disparities. This week, we're focusing on Goal 1, which is to transform healthcare by reducing disparities in coverage and access to care, reducing disparities in access to primary care and care coordination, and reducing disparities in the quality of healthcare. As we've seen over the past few months, more than 7.1 million people have gotten coverage through the marketplace, and more than 3 million have enrolled in Medicaid and CHIP. But as the President said, the ACA is much more than a website. It's an opportunity to improve healthcare quality, population health, as well as to improve our workforce and expand it. And as we end open enrollment, we now have a time to turn and focus our attention on some of those activities that have been quietly going underway below the radar while we focus so much on the enrollment that has happened for coverage. One of those things is the creation of several offices of minority health, including the CMS Office of Minority Health, which is sponsoring the webinar that we have today. We've been focused on another number of activities in terms of reducing disparities throughout the agency and working to embed these opportunities throughout the work and building partnerships across CMS and HHS to address these issues. And we're very pleased to have with us today some of our colleagues who we've been able to begin that partnership with through CMMI's Partnership for Patients, as well as our Center for Clinical Standards and Quality. And I want to thank Dennis and Paul and Xanthia for their leadership on these issues, as today we know that Partnership for Patients is focusing on reducing disparities through their work. And we are incredibly grateful for that and for the opportunity to work with them as we move forward with this. Today's session will feature a presentation by our team for the Partnership for Patients. And then we are very honored to have with us Dr. Bruce Siegel, who's President and CEO of America's Essentials Hospitals, will be talking about some of the work that they've been doing as one of the only safety net networks of hospitals throughout the country. So I'm going to introduce our speakers from our Center for Clinical Standards and Quality and then turn it over to them so we can begin the discussion and get to a very rich dialogue at the end. So first, I would like to introduce Paul McGann, who is the co-director of Partnership for Patients and deputy chief medical officer for Campaign for Leadership at the Innovation Center, the Center for Clinical Standards and Quality. Dr. McGann has been with CMS for a long time, working on a variety of issues and making sure that we're improving quality, including the ninth scope of work for the quality improvement organizations, as well as working with the ESRD network program, and throughout the efforts with the Partnership for Patients. Also, we have Dennis Wagner, who is a national leader, an international leader in the fields of healthcare quality improvement. He has been as well in a Partnership for Patients as one of the co-directors and as associate director for the campaign leader in the Center for Innovation. Prior to his current CMS postings, Dennis served as Associate Deputy Director and then Acting Director in the CMS Clinical Standards for Quality and worked for 12 years at HRSA, including a final stint as the Acting Director of HRSA's Office for Health Information Technology and Quality. And with him is Xanthia James, who is a health insurance specialist for the Quality Improvement Innovation Model Testing Group in the CMS Center for Clinical Standards and Quality, and serves as a team lead for the Partnership for Patients Health Equity and Health Disparities efforts. Prior to joining CMS, Xanthia worked for the HRSA Bureau of Primary Health Care and was a project officer and developer of funding opportunity announcements for the FQHC program. Additionally, Ms. James is a dedicated public health practitioner with over 8 years of experience in the public health field. Again, thank you for joining us, and I will turn it over to Paul.
Thank you, Dr. James. We are absolutely delighted to be here on behalf of the Center for Clinical Standards and Quality. Appreciate that you have been such a great partner together with your team here in the Office of Minority Health to the Partnership for Patients, and we share your commitment to reducing disparities in health outcomes and are really happy to be part of this call today. So on behalf of Dr. McGann, Xanthia, and myself, we're really pleased to be here. If I could have the next slide, we're really going to try to do three things over the course of the next 20 minutes, Dr. McGann, Xanthia, and I, provide you an overview of the Partnership for Patients, summarize some of our emerging results, and in particular, Xanthia is going to discuss our efforts to engage hospitals in reducing disparities in health outcomes. That's really what we're all about. If I could have the next slide. For those of you that might just be getting familiar with the Partnership for Patients, we're really defined by our aims, which are bold aims. These are not typical of what you typically might see with government programs. These are stretch goals, a 40% reduction in preventable hospital-acquired conditions, so seeking to eliminate harm for almost 2 million people. Achieving this aim will save us about 60,000 lives, so a bold aim. A 20% reduction in 30-day readmissions is our second aim, and that means that 1.6 million patients would recover without readmissions over the course of the 3 years of the Partnership for Patients. This defines our work. If I could have the next slide. So how is it, you know, that the federal government, outside partners, and others organize themselves to achieve these aims? And our work isn't sort of confined to a single program or a single silo or even a single funding stream. Our work cuts across what we call three engines, and that is aligned federal programs, not just the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, but the full strength and might of the Department of Health and Human Services, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, the Centers for Disease Control, HRSA, where both Xanthia and I spent a number of years. So using every available federal lever, whether it's technical assistance, quality improvement, payment programs, reporting programs to achieve the results, teamed aggressively with outside partners who represent patients, who represent providers, who represent researchers, unions, associations, and others, and then backed up by an investment that the CMS Innovation Center is making in this work of over $500 million. This is the way that we're seeking to get this work done. If I could have the next slide. We're focused squarely on 10 key priorities that flow directly from those two aims. And these 10 priorities are made up of 9 forms of harm that patients can experience most commonly in hospitals, seeking to eliminate those harms, and then the work to reduce readmissions, which also is tied in many cases to patient safety and harm. And I think one of the things that we've learned from working closely with patients over the course of the Partnership for Patients is no patient wants to go to a hospital that's good at preventing 3 forms of harm or 2 forms of harm. And many hospitals are focused on sort of reducing falls or reducing central line associated bloodstream infections and have that as, say, a focus of theirs, or 2 other harms. And what we have to do as hospitals and as healthcare leaders is get good at making hospitals safe for patients across all forms of harm. And I think that's really one of the unique contributions of the Partnership for Patients. And the good news is that hospitals have shown themselves able to do this. It really is a question of spread. These aren't the only forms of harm, though. And if I could have the next slide, the work of the Partnership for Patients, particularly over the course of its final 15 months, is focused on not only addressing the most common forms of harm, but also some of those new and emerging topics and issues that relate to other forms of harm that patients can experience in hospital. Things like sepsis or unnecessary exposure to radiation, which is becoming an increasing problem as our diagnostic and testing capabilities grow. This is an area of harm that patients and providers are increasingly sensitive to. So we're expanding beyond those original areas of harm. Now, we work with the best of the best. If I could have the next slide, the Innovation Center investment that is made in this work, one of those three engines, is aimed at supporting now over 3,700 hospitals across the United States. These hospitals represent almost 80% of patient discharges. Working to support these hospitals that have voluntarily joined the Partnership for Patients and are receiving support from what we call hospital engagement networks. And these hospital engagement networks are the leaders in the hospital community and are leaders in work to use quality improvement as a driver to make care better. These are names of organizations that I'm sure many of the people on this call are familiar with. The American Hospital Association, Joint Commission Resources, Ascension Health. You'll see one of the hospital engagement networks here, National Public Hospital and Health Institute, has recently undergone a name change, and I'm sitting across the table from their CEO, Bruce Siegel. This organization is now called America's Essential Hospitals, and we affectionately call them the EHEN, one of the 27 hospital engagement networks who are working hard every single day, 24/7, to reduce harm and to reduce readmissions across this very large network of hospitals that are making tremendous progress. And we're going to talk with you briefly about that progress. And with that in mind, I'm going to turn this over to Dr. Paul McGann, my colleague and co-director. Dr. McGann?
Thanks very much, Dennis, and it's great to be with all of you today. I hope we can share some of the excitement of this program, which is now getting into its maturity. We're past the two-year mark, and I'm going to share with you today what our data system looks like. We're very excited by this. We've never done something quite this ambitious in the government before. If you could go to the next slide, I'll show you what I mean. We have a data system that I was trying to think of a way to do it quickly. It's complex and it has many different streams, and we rely on many different partners, some of which are outlined on the slide. But I came up with the word that would apply to this data system. It's a data system that's very inclusive. And so you see three broad categories of data on this screen, starting with the first one, which comes directly from our hand partners themselves in the field, the hospital engagement networks that Dennis just talked about. The one in the middle is called leading indicators, and that's kind of in between one and three. And you see it comes from a lot of our partners in the Partnership for Patients. The American Nurses Association produces an ND-NQI database. The CDC produces NHSN for hospital-acquired infections and other things. We also use our own fee-for-service database here at CMS. And then the final line on this card is the national scorecard. This comes from AHRQ, and I would say it's very accurate, and we are very, very glad we have it. But it's more of a traditional approach to measurement, and it comes with very long data lags, in excess of a year, closer to 18 or 20 months. We like to have it. I'm going to show you samples of data from all three of these systems, but we think this inclusivity lets us see the elephant in much greater detail and helps people that work with us to achieve results much faster than we've been able to achieve them in the past. If you go to the next slide, this is the bottom line. I'm going to show you a few examples very rapidly, but the bottom line is all three of these data streams are showing improvement now, 2 years after the beginning of the Partnership for Patients. The hand-level data, which is near real-time, shows significant increases in the number of hospitals reporting and improving on multiple causes of harm, all at the same time through December 2013. The leading indicators data show improvement in almost every single priority area, and we're very excited. We're getting now preliminary pictures, they aren't final, of the 2012 AHRQ National Scorecard data. Remember, our most accurate data stream, and I'm going to show you what that looks like in preliminary and draft form. If you go to the next slide, what you'll see is a picture, it's a line graph of what we call engagement results and harm reduction. And the very top line there just gives you an idea of how we're getting data on multiple harms at the same time. Previous projects I worked on have worked on at most one or two or at most three harms. And you can see now we have over 3,000 hospitals reporting every single month to the Partnership for Patients database on six or more adverse event areas. The middle line there are hospitals that are demonstrating improvement in six or more adverse event areas, over half the hospitals in our network. And finally, the one we're most proud of is that dotted line on the bottom. And that shows you that almost one quarter of hospitals working with us, are achieving benchmark results in reducing harm and creating safety in their hospitals on six or more harms at exactly the same time, simultaneous improvement. Things like this have never been seen before, so this is truly a new day and a new result. I'm going to show you two quick examples of what this looks like for specific harm areas. This is the reduction, the national reduction in early elective deliveries. Leah Binder, the CEO of the LeapFrog Group, did a press release on her contribution to this, which was the public reporting end of it, and kindly included all of the partners, including the Partnership for Patients, in her release. But this is truly what national cooperation and aligned incentives look like. This is the reduction in the early elective delivery rate over the last 18 to 24 months in over 1,500 hospitals and 21 hospital engagement networks. And you'll see, if you look at that closely, that we've dropped the rate from 8%, and in many states it was 20 or 30%, down to 4%. We were aiming for 5%, and it represents over a 44% reduction in a very short period of time. This is unprecedented results, and those early elective delivery rates are plummeting still. We have entire hospital engagement networks that have almost reached zero now, and this saves thousands of babies' lives nationally. If you go to the next slide, it's another very impressive result that we're very proud of, everyone pulling together to reduce unnecessary 30-day readmissions. That line you see, this comes from our own Medicare data set, fee-for-service Medicare beneficiaries here at CMS, and that line you can see hovered around the 18, 19, 20% range for 10 years or more without budging. And as soon as we started this partnership with everyone pulling together, the HENS, the QIOs, the CCTP programs, and many others, you can see for the first time in 10 years, a national measure of 30-day readmissions is starting to go down, and it's still going down to this very day. That shows you data on this slide up till September of last year. And then finally, I promised you an early peek at the AHRQ national scorecard data. That's shown on this slide. And you can see, averaged over all the hospital-acquired conditions, we have the ability now with this AHRQ data set to measure harms per 1,000 discharges, no matter what the cause. It's truly an all-cause harm measure. And you can see it's gone down from our baseline year of 2010 of 145 harms per 1,000 discharges. And it's looking like through 2012, with that data lag, that we're going to get down to 132 harms per 1,000 discharges as a national estimate. That's a 9% reduction. Very, very impressive across multiple hacks. It's about 22 different causes of harm. And this is associated, you can see in the other bullets, with huge cost savings. $3 to $4 billion is an initial estimate, and tens of thousands of lives saved. So this is really something that we've never seen before in the history of quality improvement in hospitals in this country. And these numbers I just went over are very relevant when we start talking about disparities, as we will in a minute. But Dennis, we wanted to pause here and really underscore our commitment to bringing along the active reduction of healthcare disparities and the elimination of inequity as part of this program.
We are extremely committed in the Partnership for Patients, Dr. McGann, myself, our entire CMS team, to effectively addressing and reducing health disparities, and it is a key focus of our work. I'm delighted that our next speaker here in a few minutes, Xanthia James, is going to be able to speak to you directly about some of the activities that are underway, but Dr. McGann and I are going to give you just a high-level overview. This isn't a single thing that we're doing. This is a multidimensional, multifaceted, multi-pronged effort to address health disparities as part of the work of the Partnership for Patients, which includes data collection and analysis. We're investing in it as part of the contracts that we have with hospital engagement networks. This is funded work. And the thing that I find most exciting about this, I actually led an effort at HRSA over a three-year period called the Campaign for 100% Access and Zero Health Disparities. And that effort, like this effort, is focused laser-like on identifying what's already working in hospitals where it's already working, and then working aggressively to spread those practices. It is an upward-lifting, upward-spiraling activity, and you're going to hear a couple of examples from Xanthia of hospitals, the Alameda Health System in Oakland, the University of Washington Medical Center, that are leaders in this effort. I know that Dr. Siegel is going to talk about Truman Medical Centers and San Mateo Medical Center. So we have things here in hand that we can replicate and reproduce. We're very excited about that. This is a major focus of our work, Dr. McGann.
Yes, it is. And we really want to emphasize what Dr. James said at the beginning. This project is not focused on data. We document our progress with data, but we're focused on action. And all of our partners are focused on action. And every hospital engagement network doesn't just want to document data and publish papers. Every hospital engagement network wants to achieve safety across the board, across multiple harms for all members of the population, especially for vulnerable populations. That's a commitment of this project. If you go to the next slide, I'll just give you a very high-level overview before I turn over to Xanthia of what the data in the disparities realm is starting to show us. It's still at the early stages and it isn't complete. We don't have final data here, but we want to show you what we have so far. So what we have so far is, I think it's the next slide after this.
Yeah, we should advance one slide.
Yes. So what you're seeing on these pie charts here is analysis from the Partnership for Patients national baseline data. Remember I said the baseline is calendar year 2010. And we have an analysis from our special data set, which is the most accurate one, and it's called the MPSMS for Medicare Patient Safety Monitoring System. We're working now, and I'm showing you on these graphs the 2010 data. We're getting the preliminary 2011 data, and then we're going to dive into the 2012 data, which is the very last data that's just assembling itself now. And we have them for adverse drug events, for pressure ulcers, for hospital-acquired conditions, and a number of other causes of harm. And we're also looking at exposures, and we can probably talk a little bit more about that in the question and answer period. This graph in particular, on the very, you see four pie charts on your screen, and in the very final, very top pie chart, you see the distribution now through nine core areas of harm. We do the harm differently than readmissions, and then all other areas of harm, so a total of 10 slices on this pie chart, if you will, and that's for all patients. And you can see, using the data in MPSMS that comes from HRQ, we have the ability at a national level to get nationally representative samples for white patients, which is the first of the three on the bottom row, for black patients, which is the middle one, and for all other, in other words, non-white, non-black, in the third pie chart. And you can see, even at this initial stage, there are significant differences here. The most common adverse event is ADEs. And for white patients, that's 47% of the total. But for black patients, it's 63%, much, much higher. And then you see higher rates of pressure ulcers for white patients. You see lower rates of pressure ulcers for black patients in the middle pie chart. And you can compare at your leisure all of the data. And this data is coming together and will allow each of our hospital engagement networks to prioritize their projects and to actually start eliminating these disparities in healthcare quality.
I want to take just a moment, Dr. McGann, if I could, and acknowledge that Noel Eldridge of AHRQ is one of our key partners who I actually think is on the call. We just want to acknowledge that AHRQ leads this work, as you said, and Noel Eldridge in particular has been instrumental in pulling out of that data the work that we see illustrated here in terms of the distribution across various populations.
That's right, Dennis. And we couldn't do it without him. So thank you to Noel and all his colleagues at AHRQ, our sister agency. At this point, I know we are running down the clock here, so I'm going to turn it over to Xanthia James, and she's going to actually give you a flavor of how we do this work and how we focus our attention and prioritize the elimination of health disparities in the hospital engagement part of the Partnership for Patients. Xanthia?
Okay, thank you. So we can advance to the next slide. So last fall, we added a new task that now requires all of the HIMSS to engage their hospitals in addressing health disparities. And we, you know, left it to them as to how they would approach that. However, we encouraged them to engage leadership in discussions on how to use data to track disparities in harm and readmissions. And we also encouraged them to spread examples of successful hospital programs that have been engaged in addressing disparities. So we could advance to the next slide, please. So now I want to share with you just a few examples of how of what our HIMSS are doing to reduce health disparities. As you can see, our HIMSS are heavily engaged in leadership engagement, and they're specifically engaging them in discussions on using race, ethnicity, and language data to track and address health disparities, and also awareness, spreading awareness within the leadership, within hospital leadership in addressing disparities that are found for specific hospital-acquired illnesses. Go to the next slide. Here's some more examples of how our HINs are addressing health disparities. Our HINs are also addressed in addressing diversity in hospital leadership and diversity in disparities within specific patient populations. For example, you have the Washington State Hospital addressing the quality of service for the LGBT population. The next slide, please. And here's some additional examples of how HINs are engaging their hospital networks in addressing health disparities. For example, you have you have the Michigan HIN that is addressing disparities within the treatment of patients that are experiencing mental health issues. And you also have several, there are several HINs that are addressed in increasing the use of culturally and linguistically appropriate service training for their hospital staff. Advance to the next slide. So in 2012, the Partnership for Patients joined efforts with the Indian Health Service to develop a new network, hospital engagement network, comprised of 28 IHS hospitals. And these hospitals are now collecting data on 10 of the PFP-targeted hospital-acquired conditions, and they are reporting on that data. Go to the next slide, please. And I'm going to share with you just a couple of examples of what the hospitals within our hospital, some of our hospital engagement networks are doing. So this is an example of what the University of Washington Medical Center is doing to address disparities. They pretty much went out to, they reached out to the a Somali community within their community and are working with them to develop a relationship to spread health education within that group so they can increase or improve the health outcomes. And specifically, I want to note about this partnership that this was a community-based participatory partnership. So the Somali population actually identified the their health needs, and the University of Washington partnered with them to find ways to help them address their health needs, healthcare needs. So go advance to the next slide, please. Okay, here's another example of what our hospitals are doing to address disparities. So the Highland Hospital in Oakland, California, their trauma department saw high numbers of elderly patients presenting in their emergency department for falls. And so in order to address this problem and stop the cycle of the readmissions for this population, they joined forces with the Fall Prevention Center to develop a comprehensive assessment and screening and referral services for this particular population. Advance to the next slide, please. We also have a vulnerable populations affinity group, and the goal of this group is to increase equity and safety across the board for all health outcomes. And what it does is it provides a forum for advocacy input. So we have representatives from the HINs. We have hospital experts and also patient advocates as well as CMS officials that participate on this affinity group to help spread best practices amongst the HINs. I'll go to the next slide, please. And lastly, here are just some other examples of collaboration within HHS and the CMS Office of Minority Health and others to address health disparities. So we also have participation by the HHS Office of Minority Health. They are a member of our federal partner team, And they, this is a team that basically works together to come up with ways to partner to support the efforts of the Partnership for Patients program. We also partner with the with OASH, which is also planning to conduct a pilot with several of our HINs to address disparities in ADEs. And that concludes our presentation. I'm now going to turn over the presentation back to Dr. Kara James.
Thank you, Xanthia, Dennis, and Paul for that. I don't really want to take questions right now, but we have had a number of questions come in about some of the data that was presented. A number of people are interested in whether or not the data can be disaggregated beyond black and white to look at some of the other groups, and I didn't know if that was something you could speak to. I know that Dr. Siegel is going to talk a lot about what we're looking at for some of the race ethnicity data, but if that was something you could address now.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Jane. The data that we showed you, remember on that first slide that I said we had an inclusive data set, means that we have several different data sources that we can address. For this presentation and for the purposes of the HRQ National Scorecard, we address the one source of that data, which has the longest data lag and is the most accurate. That's the MPSMS data. That data set is not going to permit us to disaggregate it any more than I showed you on those pie charts between white, black, and other. The denominators aren't big enough in that data set, which is done from chart review samples, to disaggregate further. But you will recall on the overview data slide, we had multiple other data sources. I haven't counted them, but I'd say there's at least 10 other data sources. Dr. Siegel is going to talk about one of them that comes from his own hospital engagement network. And in those areas, it is possible to disaggregate and get at exactly the question that you're asking. We chose today at the national level to focus on the AHRQ data set, and that's why we showed you that summary slide. That's the limit that this data set will allow with any degree of statistical accuracy.
Thank you. And that is definitely one of the challenges when we're doing disparities work. I would also say for those of you who are interested, it's not the most current data, but if you want an overview of disparities in some of the harm areas, the National Healthcare Disparities Report has data that's much more lagged, but does disaggregate into a few of the other racial and ethnic populations. And the other questions that we're getting a lot are, will the slides be available and is this recorded? And the answer to both of those questions is yes, and we'll let you know about that as we follow up. So I want to turn now to introduce Dr. Bruce Siegel, who is the president and CEO of America's Essential Hospitals. And Dr. Siegel has an extensive background in healthcare management, policy, and public health. As Dennis and Paul mentioned, America's Essential Hospitals is the only national organization representing hospitals committed to caring for the uninsured and other vulnerable populations. And under Dr. Siegel's guidance, it's helped shape the association's work in advocacy, membership support, and quality. He led the launch of the Transformation Center, which is a catalyst for innovative change to improve quality and safety. And as part of the Essential Hospitals Institute, the association's researched arm, and established the first patient safety net quality network under the CMS Partnership for Patients. Dr. Siegel also has an extensive background working in the area of disparity specifically, and we are very pleased that he's able to join us today to talk about some of the work that America's Essential Hospitals has been doing in this very important area. Dr. Siegel?
Thank you, Cara. I very much appreciate being here, and thanks to Paul and Xanthia and Dennis also for, taking leadership in this area. I did spend some time before I got to this job 3 years ago. I spent about a decade working in quality and disparities at George Washington University. And I can say personally how exciting this is. 8 or 9 years ago, many of us were just so frustrated that the area of equity and disparities was not really meeting with the area of quality and moving outcomes. And now I think I can say, thanks to the Partnership for Patients, thanks to the CMS Office of Minority Health, these two have come together in a very powerful way and a very national way. Let me just spend a minute talking about America's Essential Hospitals. We were known as a National Association of Public Hospitals until recently. We have about 200 public and nonprofit health systems. Our patients tend to be disproportionately Medicaid patients or uninsured patients. I should also note that at our sort of average hospital, most of the patients are people of color. They're African Americans, Latinos, or members of other vulnerable underrepresented minority groups. We have very high levels of acuity in our hospitals, trauma centers, lots of burn units and NICUs, deliver a lot of babies, and train about one out of five American physicians. So we are very much at the nexus not only of you know, very high acuity and high access care, but also in caring for the most vulnerable in our country. I won't spend a lot of time talking about disparities. I assume people on this call know about them. But you know, we really view disparities through a quality lens, that disparities are differences in quality of health care that members of different groups are experiencing that are really not explained by other factors. And they can occur at any stage in the continuum of care. We can see them in the beginning of life, middle of life, and the end of life. We can see them in primary preventive services, secondary, tertiary care, quaternary care. The healthcare system, they're really endemic in the healthcare system. And I think at last count, there were something like close to 4,000 published articles in the literature documenting healthcare disparities. And all of this is a failure in quality. Now, you know, why should we continue to focus on disparities? Well, let's look at the current, you know, situation and give three very clear examples here on this slide. We know that black patients have a 13% higher chance of readmissions than white patients for MI, heart failure, and pneumonia. We know that patients of inadequate health literacy are less likely than patients of adequate health literacy to have good control of their diabetes through tight glycemic control. We also know that preterm birth rates are one-third higher for non-Hispanic African Americans. So three sort of very clear examples in three areas of how disparities in healthcare interact and how really disparities are a failing in quality and to get the right outcomes. Now, we have to care about this more and more because, frankly, the demographics of our country are changing so rapidly. This gives you, you know, the red bars are non-Hispanic whites. The gray bar is, quote, others. I hate that term, but that's a term we often use. Everybody else. And we can see that everybody else is close to being the major part of our population today and will be, you know, majority by 2050 and maybe sooner. Frankly, the populations we often talk about in the racial and ethnic populations and disparities are becoming a majority of America and will not be minorities anymore. And I think because of this, disparities are no longer a nice thing to do. They are central and core to the mission of any healthcare organization because the majority of their patients who they will be treating in the future will be patients who we have documented have suffered from healthcare disparities. Now, we've taken a role in a number of areas in trying to move the bar around this. We're a founding partner in the national call to action around equity of care, which I'll talk about in a little bit, that's focused on a few areas. We have put out a blueprint a number of years ago with the Office of Minority Health from HHS on assuring healthcare equity, which is sort of a roadmap for healthcare organizations, and you can see the link here, and we invite you to download that. And through our hospital engagement network, we're making this work front and center, not only for the couple of dozen major health systems in the network, but really for any hospital in America who wants to be a part of that, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Let me turn first to the National Call to Action to Eliminate Healthcare Disparities. This was founded in 2011. It really, leaders from five associations came together, the AAMC, the American College of Health Executives, Healthcare Executives, the American Hospital Association, the Catholic Health Association, and ourselves, and to really create a national call to action to eliminate disparities using three core elements. And you see those three elements here. The first is to increase the collection and use of race, ethnicity, and language data. And I'll talk a little bit more about why that is important. Second is to increase cultural competency training. And third, perhaps the most difficult, but I would argue in some ways most critical because it's about leadership, is to increase diversity in governance and leadership. And all five of these organizations aren't just talking about this. We have committed to measurable benchmarks, which are on this slide, that we're going to achieve by certain dates to move the ball in these three areas. And this is the first time anything like this has happened. And we'll be holding ourselves accountable, and we invite you to hold us accountable as well. Let me now turn to the work of the Essential Hospitals Engagement Network, or EHEN, under the Partnership for Patients. You know, I won't go through what Dennis and Paul talked about in terms of, you know, what outcomes we're trying to move. But we're approaching it really on two levels. One on the left is to activate leadership across our members. I'll talk about that in a minute. It is absolutely essential that everyone from the boards and CEOs and through in these entire organizations make quality, and as part of that, disparities an organizational priority. And we've had, frankly, you know, with the funding of the Partnership for Patients, the ability to bring our leaders together, bring them together with national experts, folks like Jim Reinertsen, to really challenge them with their data, and ask them the hard questions about how are you going to improve, what are you going to do tomorrow? And we have seen the results of that. We've had monthly webinars of our leaders, and it really focused them on building a culture of safety. We also know we have to engage the front line as well, and we've been doing that in a number of ways, everything else from feeding the data back in real time to to sitting with our folks and talking to them and getting them to understand what that data is saying and not saying, and what are the tools for improvement that they can implement, again, in a very rapid cycle. Now, we have focused on REAL data, and I'll go to the next slide here if we could. And REAL stands for race, ethnicity, and language data. Let me put it very simply. You can't improve on disparities, and frankly, I don't think you can be a modern healthcare organization if you don't know who your patients are today. And in too many American hospitals, including ours, leadership, frankly, no one in the hospital knows who the patients are. I'll give you an example of a hospital I visited a few years ago. Walked down the hallways. The signage was all in English. Turns out the community they serve is 40% Latino. Leadership didn't know that. They didn't know that because they were not consistently asking the patients when they came in the door what their ethnicity was, Hispanic or not Hispanic, asking them about their race or asking about their primary language or language preferences. They were disconnected from their community and disconnected from their customers in a very important way that we know impacts the quality of care these folks will have and their patient experience and everything else. That gives you an example of the very basic things you need to know. We also know that very often, and sometimes in terms of hospitals, within hospitals, they're going to see differences in quality outcomes for different groups of patients. But again, if they don't know who their patients are, they won't be able to find those differences in any meaningful fashion. So we have dedicated our hospitals to collecting high-quality race, ethnicity, and language data on all their patients coming in the door and asking them the very simple questions about who they are and then linking that to their quality outcomes to look for disparities and to be better providers of service to their customers. The bad news is most American hospitals weren't doing a good job of this a few years ago. On some earlier slides, you saw some data about that from the call to action. The good news is it's changing. It's changing very quickly. I think the surveys that are being done by a number of organizations are going to show improvement in this area over time, and we're really trying to take the lead on this and make it happen. So on the next page, you'll see some of these very granular activities. We've started a systems of distance learning events, a series of distance learning events around achieving equity in the safety net, building health literacy, and improving care for limited English proficiency patients. And let me be clear, all these distance learning events are available to everyone who wants to log on. Go to essentialhospitals.org, our website, and register. These are open to the public, funded by the Partnership for Patients, and also obviously open to HEN hospitals as well. Within our HEN hospitals also, though, we've asked them all to form, within those couple of dozen systems, an equity action team to make this a priority and to really go forward with the collection of race, ethnicity, and language data. And actually, we're developing as part of this an electronic learning module that could be used hopefully in every hospital in America. And we'll hopefully stay tuned on that. The next slide gets to one of the questions that came up earlier about going beyond race to ethnicity. And this shows across about 20 hospitals data results around asking folks around ethnicity when they come into the hospital. And what you can see here is back in 2010 in these hospitals, there was no data on fully half the patients on whether or not they were of Hispanic origin. That's the green bar at top, 49%. And now, because of these activities, we've dropped that down to 25%. So this is some evidence that we're starting to get better data, not just on race, but on the ethnicity of patients. Are they Hispanic or not Hispanic as well? Got a long ways to go, but this shows you can move the bar here, and it's absolutely critical that we do that. A couple of real-life examples before I wrap. We heard about Highland Hospitals before in downtown Oakland. Wright Lassiter is the CEO there, really a leader in disparities in America. And we also talk about San Mateo Medical Center, not too far away on the San Francisco Peninsula, an important safety net hospital. They've moved down the pathway of collecting high-quality data and looking at whether or not they have disparities in their care. They have found a very interesting outcome, which they're trying to investigate. You know, most of their patients are of Hispanic origin at San Mateo Medical Center, yet actually few of their patients being seen in their cardiology clinics are of Hispanic origin. Now, that could be due to a lot of reasons, but they're concerned that it could be about access, and are there barriers going on that need to be explored? So that gives you a sense of how they're using the data to understand better how their system is caring for people. Another example on the next slide is that of Truman Medical Center, which is really, you know, enjoyed the leadership now of John Bluford, who many of you know for many years, as well as their medical director, Shauna Roberts. They've been at this for a few years. They essentially have an equity of care dashboard that their management uses in their hospital that stratifies their core measures, looks at mortality, length of stay, and readmissions by race, ethnicity, age, and gender. That's reviewed on a monthly basis by their diversity council as well as their quality folks. They have found higher readmission rates there in their population, which is in Kansas City, Missouri, for African Americans, and also lower vaccination rates for pneumococcal and influenza vaccines. And they're working with their pharmacists and health coaches to try to move that bar. They found a lot of patients refusing vaccination because, frankly, it wasn't being explained to them in terms of what it was, the, you know, perhaps the minimal risks, in a way that they could really begin to understand. And they're sort of going back and looking at those processes, and when the patient refuses, triggering a consult with pharmacy to try to make sure that the patient is best educated as possible before they walk out without the vaccination. So anyway, that gives you a little bit of sense. I know we're going to have a lot of questions, but we're thrilled to be a part of this work. And again, we, you know, direct you to essentialhospitals.org to be a part of this work as we move ahead. And back to Cara.
Thank you so much, Dr. Siegel. And I, again, want to thank all of our speakers for such wonderful presentations that are really, as we talk about, focusing on action and moving the ball forward. We have had a couple of questions come in. One, since Dr. Siegel, you were just talking about real data that I'm going to ask you. And the question was, when you talk about the collection of Hispanic, is Hispanic the only ethnicity information collected, or is ethnicity information for various race groups also being collected? So,
yes. So let me talk a minute, a minute about that. This has been an area of inquiry for IOM and others. So currently, under the OMB guidelines, which are used in the census, for instance, there are a number of different groups who fall under race. In terms of black, you know, white, Asian and Pacific Islander, et cetera. And then ethnicity is Hispanic Latino or not Hispanic Latino. And that's a separate dimension. So you're asking the patient two different questions. Obviously, in our communities, ethnicity goes far beyond that. You know, so for instance, I am an African American, but I'm also a Haitian American. And that might be very meaningful in many communities as well. So our encouragement to hospitals, and I think this is consistent with what others would say, is, you know, definitely do the race, definitely do Hispanic and not Hispanic, but then go beyond that to, you know, greater granularity, depending on where your community is, where you may look at ethnicity much more broadly than that. But we see that as sort of being the bare minimum.
Thank you. And operator, if you could queue up for questions while we are taking this next question, I would appreciate that.
Okay. As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Please limit your questions to one question and one follow-up question to allow other participants time for questions. If you require any further follow-up, you may press star one again to rejoin the queue.
Thank you. And while we're getting the queue together, one of the other questions that we received and is related to what we know about the causes of readmissions. And so I was wondering if any of you could speak to what we know about some of those causes and how that plays out in some of our minority communities.
Okay. I'll start and let my colleagues, you know, go off. We think, you know, the causes of readmissions are very multifactorial. I don't think anybody thinks it's simple. I'm not sure we fully understand the cause of readmissions. You know, part of it, you know, starts with, you know, our jobs as providers and educating our patients and making sure we do things like the things that are called for under Project Red that came out of Boston Medical Center, so that when a patient's going home, they have everything they need to know about how to manage their care, are plugged into primary care afterwards, are, you know how to, you know, take their medications and many other things that I think, you know, Paul and Dennis can talk about at much greater, you know, facility than I can. Part of it is about the social and economic supports they have, certainly, when they come out of the hospital. You know, where are they going? Are they going back to a safe and secure environment with family support, or maybe not? You know, are they going to a homeless shelter? I mean, we see some of that in our hospitals. And certainly a lot of that is about language barriers, about, you know, perhaps health literacy and many other things. So it is so complex. I think the good news is that, you know, most hospitals now get it, that they have a role in this. I think they realize they need to have partners in this work. But I think we've gotten past the point where folks feel like, wow, this is really not outside of my control and not something I have to worry about.
The two things I'd add, this is Paul McGann, are communication and leadership. We're just seeing this over and over again in the Partnership for Patients in the last 2 years, and I think Dr. Siegel's presentation is a great example of leadership in just this direction. But communication and styles of communication, even the awareness, Dr. Siegel cited an example of a hospital in a largely Hispanic area where everything was in English and no one had even bothered to ask the question, could there be language barriers here? And that's so important in the practice of medicine, in the conduction of procedures, various procedures in the hospital that result in some of the harms and the procedural harm, adverse drug events. If there isn't good communication and an attempt to reach the patient and the family where they are and from their perspective, important medical information can be overlooked and procedures can be done that perhaps the patient or the family didn't want to be done in the first place. And so communication is so important. But I have to say over the last year, especially in the Partnership for Patients, I'm just so impressed at the difference that leadership makes. This applies to disparities, but it also applies just to harming patients in general. I should mention here that I misspoke on the pie graphs. The data labels here look like percentages to me, but Noel Eldridge reminded me that these are the absolute rates. So that 47.4 per 1,000 rate of ADEs that went up to 63.4 per 1,000 discharges, those are absolute rates of adverse drug events, and the 63.4 number was the higher rate in African Americans. And a leader will take numbers like that and reflect them back to his organization, and he'll say, why do we have an adverse drug event rate in African Americans that's 20 absolute points higher than the general population? And when the leader does that and expects accountability and answers, that's when the action that Dr. James was referring to starts happening. And so we're more and more convinced as the Partnership for Patients goes on that strong leadership and strong leadership messages about pursuing hospital safety and pursuing hospital safety with equity are two of the most powerful messages that can get out there. And we now have the tools and the ability to measure that in very real and meaningful ways.
Thank you. Operator, do we have any questions in the queue?
Yes, your first question comes from Alina Rios with National Hispanic Medical Association. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. Thank you for the presentations, and I'm sorry I started in late, but my question has to do with the Affordable Care Act ability to have incentives for workforce, and I know there's an important role for the team. And so in terms of the innovations that the Affordable Care Act is really focusing on integrated training and team training and clinic teaching, and I guess I'm just wondering, what are your thoughts on short-term priorities? I mean, I know everything's going to change over time, but short-term priorities, and what would be your priority direction for our advocates to know about in terms of where you're headed, what you're thinking in terms of CMS.
Thank you, Dr. Rios. It's Paul McGann. I don't know if you remember me, but we did work on some disparities projects 3 years ago when I was over in the CCSQ front office. and enjoyed that time together very much on every person with diabetes counts. I think you make a very good observation, and what I would say now in my new position as co-director of the Partnership for Patients is that the investment in the Partnership for Patients intervention from the Innovation Center, which is under Affordable Care Act funding, was very much in the line of collaborative quality improvement at over 3,700 of the nation's hospitals. And the total amount of investment was $500 million in that particular intervention. And I would say we can ask Dr. Siegel, because he's the director of one of those 27 hospital engagement networks, but I would say from what I've seen that a huge fraction of that $500 million investment was actually put into the workforce directed at quality. And I know in America's essential hospitals, it was workforce directed at quality with attention to health equity and the reduction, elimination of disparities. So I think by various interventions and projects that come out of the CMS Innovation Center and are funded by it, it's possible to deploy workforce-oriented projects in the field. I know that there are several other healthcare innovation awards through the Innovation Center that also focus on the healthcare workforce, including community workforce issues with community health workers, for example. Mm-hmm. And so the whole spirit of innovation in the CMS Innovation Center that really hosts the Partnership for Patients, I think, is one of the mechanisms to accomplish the important goal that you outlined. Bruce, do you have anything you want to
add? Yeah, I would just add to that. Mm-hmm. I think that's spot on. I would add to that, you know, the drop we're seeing in readmission rates, which, you know, seems to be real. And sustained now, to me, is evidence of a team-based approach. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure we'd be seeing that outcome. I don't think we would if we were relying on single providers to make this happen. Because the causation of readmissions we talked about is so complicated, it needs a team to address it, and I think that's evidence of that happening.
And I think just to build on a point that you made earlier in your presentation, Bruce. A lot of that shows up, the way it shows up is hospitals teaming with social service providers like area agencies on aging, for example, in ways that they hadn't previously done so. You see it with the systematic use of care transitions coaches who have an accountability, and sometimes those coaches are part of the hospital team and sometimes they're outside of the hospital with other organizations where there's an accountability in place for warm handoffs of patients from hospitals to skilled nursing facilities or long-term care facilities or home health or primary care providers or family members. So I think that team-based work is definitely coming into play in the readmissions area. We see that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, operator, I think we have time for one last question and one set of quick answers.
Okay. Your next question comes from Perry Payne with Center for Medicare. Your line is open.
Okay, thanks a lot. Hi, I'm a former colleague of Bruce Siegel, so hello, Bruce, from George Washington University. My question is that we know that race and ethnicity are really proxies for a variety of other factors, and I wonder if we're really pushing hospitals to gather data on other factors that these sort of broad categorizations of humans that have something to do with U.S. history and so on are actually capturing, like whether or not you're being discriminated or whether you're a certain income or whether you have a certain diet or so on, things that are actually actionable by physicians and hospitals and that can really be addressed instead of us really continuing to focus on these really broad, ambiguous categories of race and ethnicity.
Well, thank you for that comment. As a physician, as Paul McGann, I'll comment on the diet one because I think you're absolutely right that is so often overlooked, and that the perturbations of the American diet are leading to health problems actually in all groups, but especially in vulnerable populations. So I think the focus on diet is something that is really, really important. Xanthia mentioned another focus, which is on mental health issues, which are so often pushed off to the side. And we have specific examples in the hospital engagement networks of hospital engagement networks that are prioritizing these two dimensions that I just mentioned in terms of their work to improve safety and reduce disparities. So I know there is some action beginning on this, but I think your point is well taken, and we could probably do a lot better on both of those and many of the other dimensions of this that you talked about.
Yeah, I would just add just one thing to that. I hear what you're saying. We urge people to go beyond race and ethnicity to other dimensions, LGBT status, other things. But I think it's important to note that there really are racial and ethnic disparities in care that are independent of these other factors. And that's something that's very well documented in the literature, and I'll just leave it at that.
No, what I'm saying is that race and ethnicity are representing other factors. So if you're representing skin color, for example, we never actually ask people about their skin color. But if that's what we think is going on, we think people are being discriminated on that basis, why not ask that? So that we can actually dig deeper into the data and to finding more actionable information. I can't really change your African-Americanness, but I can at least think about, well, are we discriminating against people who have darker skin color or lighter skin color, or is that exposure somehow harming people in some way, stressing them out and so on? That's what I'm saying.
Thank you for that question, and I think that dovetails on some of the questions that we got as well about the other factors that hospitals may or may not be collecting. But we are at the hour, and I do want to again thank all of our speakers, Dennis Wagner, Paul McGann, Xanthia James, and Dr. Siegel for wonderful questions and discussions, and I want to thank all of you for your participation and interest in this very important issue. And as we continue to seek action and move the ball forward, we are hoping that we can be of resource to you and help you in that work as you're going along. I also want to take time to thank Pamela Gentry, Pat Willis, and Crystal Barnes, who are our organizers and facilitators of this event today, to help make this possible so that we could continue the conversation. If you are interested in the slides, we don't want to send them out to everyone, but for those of you who are interested, we ask you to please send an email to omh@cms.hhs.gov, and we will make sure that you get those. If you didn't get your question answered, we also, if you would like to send us an email, we can try and get that answered for you as we move forward. But again, I want to thank all of our presenters for participating in this in such wonderful conversations and for their leadership on this very important issue. And finally, we just kind of encourage you to fill out the survey. We want to be a resource and help out, so if there are other topics you're interested in, please take a moment and let us know. And I, again, continue all of your work and wish you the best. Thank you so much.
Okay, this concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.